Hello out there in internet land. It's time once again for the D&D podcast. I'm your host, Mike Merles. With me, as usual, is my co-host, Jeremy Crawford. And joining this week is our special guest from D&D R&D, Rodney Thompson.
Hello.
So, Rodney, why don't you introduce yourself and let everyone know what your job here is at Wizards.
Sure. I'm Rodney Thompson. As Mike said, I am a D&D designer. I have been a developer in the past, but now I do design work, and I have been working on lots of new D&D products, including the D&D Essentials line.
Cool.
And many people know you, Rodney, for your work on the much-esteemed Star Wars Saga.
That is true. That is true. My first job here at Wizards was working on the Star Wars Saga Edition role-playing game, and I did that for 3 years. Ran that whole game, basically.
So, speaking of design, you worked on both of the D&D products we're going to talk about today. I almost said books, but while they're both include books, only one of them is just a book.
That's right.
The other one is a box set. First one being the second player's book in the Essentials line, Heroes of the Forgotten Kingdoms. And then the other one being a box set, the Monster Vault. So we're going to start with talking about Heroes of the Forgotten Kingdoms. It's very similar to Heroes of the Fallen Lands in terms of the overall structure. Includes five races. Is that right, Rodney? Or am I getting that number right?
I believe five is correct.
Because there's humans, which is a repeat from the first book. But basically, we wanted to make this a very complete reference book. We know that human is the most popular character race. So we decided to just go ahead. It's only a couple pages. So, and in addition, there are, we got Dragonborn and Tiefling.
There are actually five other races.
It's
five new races.
Five new races. And
plus, in addition to the human.
Got it. So we have the two half-races, half-elf and half-orc. We've got Dragonborn and Tiefling. We have the humans that got picked up again. And then we have our final race is...
The Drow.
It
was on
that's
the cover.
Right. That's duh. There's a copy of the book sitting right in front of me. I wonder what that last race is. Yes, it's a drow, and they're not attacking him. The other characters are not attacking him, so presumably...
At least not yet.
Not yet.
Right.
they're just waiting for him to give his heart back to Lolth.
Or kabam! It's possible he might just be a really terrible ranger, and at some point they'll decide, you're just an XP sponge, sorry, and they'll just smack him down.
To be fair, the drow ranger is being attacked by giant rats on the cover, as far as I can tell. But that might just be the perspective.
And in the background, were-rats are rushing into the sewer, it looks like, where they're fighting.
Yep. So let's start with the races before we go into classes. Ronnie, do you want to talk a little bit about the races here? Like, what makes them different compared to anything that maybe your player out there saw in Heroes of the Fallen Lands?
Well, these races are actually, they're a little bit more... you would expect them to live a little bit more on the fringes of the D&D society, right? A little bit more in the realm of the outcast or the lone wolf, right? So you're looking at, you know, drow are obviously typically seen as villains, and then now we've elevated them to player race. We did that in the Forgotten Realms book originally, and now we've put them in the Essentials book. You've got half-elves and half-orcs, which traditionally have been seen often as outcasts from their own, you know, parentage, right? And then, you know, Dragonborn are a new race introduced in 4th edition. And then the Tiefling, of course, they have this sort of infernal heritage, which makes them a little bit more prejudiced against people in the D&D world might see them as a little more dangerous, a little darker than your typical races. So if you're looking to play a character that that it exists a little bit more on the fringes of society, the races in this book really do a good job of catering to that that character archetype, which, I mean, let's face it, that's a very popular archetype in fantasy fiction as well as all kinds of different fiction, right? So this book is really great for making sure that that archetype is well represented.
Now, in Heroes of the Fallen Lands, the human, as a race, received a new racial power that you could choose in place of the original 4th edition one, which interacted with the at-will power system. Half-elves also have that option. Instead of taking an at-will from their class, they can choose an at-will from a different class. What new mechanic can players look forward to here to serve as an alternative to that? It doesn't replace it, it's just an alternative. For half-elves built with this book.
Right, yeah. So basically, just like the human, we give you a power option now, right? It is basically a thing that you can take instead of taking another classes at will. Not only does that work well with the essentials classes because there's not the strict at will structure anymore, but it also means that if you're just not interested in taking another at will, you've got a racial power that you can use now. It's called Knack for Success, and we really actually, in fact, it was you and I sitting in the meeting where we sort of designed this power. We really tried to make it so that it embodies both the versatility and the leadership qualities of the half-elf. We've typically tended to say that, you know, half-elves, since they live sort of between two worlds, they have the ability to interact well with both groups, and so this power is really designed to emphasize that interaction with others. So it's a close burst five. You can target yourself or an ally, and basically you can choose for the target to make a saving throw, to shift up to two squares as a free action, get a power bonus to their next attack roll, or a power bonus to the next skill check. So basically, unless the half-elf be a little bit of a mini-leader, even if they're not actually a, you know, a leader class, be a little bit of a mini-leader and also represents just their versatility by the sheer number of options you have when you use it.
And like many racial powers in the game, this is something that the half-elf can do once per encounter.
That's right.
Yeah, and it's something where I think when we looked at the flavor of it, you know, kind of inspired within D&D, Tanis from the Dragonlance series. But even if you can kind of think back to, like, Tolkien, where you have Elrond as a half-elf, but he's also renowned as a leader, kind of trying to get that feel of the kind of the wise, the guy who kind of sees opportunities that other people might miss. And even if he's a fighter, or even if he's a wizard, has that wisdom to share in the form of this power. You can imagine it's you're offering guidance or shouting a warning. Or the nice thing is you can use it on yourself, too. It isn't just something for allies.
Right. So if all your allies are unconscious, for example, yeah. and you're not sitting there going, well, I'm glad I've got this great racial power
that
I can actually use.
Now a little geek trivia aside, was Elrond actually a half-elf?
No.
You're correct, sir.
Do you know how I knew that?
How did you know that?
Because you asked me, and the obvious question answer was yes. Right. So I just figured no, because otherwise you wouldn't have asked.
That's right. No, I always think it's ironic that the... sort of the whole reason why Dungeons & Dragons back in the 70s had the half-elf was because of characters from fantasy literature like Elrond, and Elrond is not actually a half-elf. So, it's his title,
yeah,
but he was given the choice of becoming either human or elven, and he chose to be an elf.
He chose to be an elf. Well, I mean, that's kind of not a hard decision, especially Middle-earth, like... immortality, incredible power, good looks.
But his brother, nice his brother wardrobe. Chose to be a human.
Why would you? I guess like was there like a half price human special at the local like tavern
two for one?
Well, he actually got to become two humans.
Yes. Yeah.
So he could have his own best friend.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So yeah, no, I thought I remember something about that story. So I wasn't like completely just trying to game your question.
Yeah. But. So this book, like Heroes of the Fallen Lands, also has classes. Rodney, what classes does this book have?
Boy, I'm just going to lead this podcast.
Yes. Okay. Well, you're our special guest.
Thank you.
No, we want you to earn your keep.
Oh, good. Right. Yeah. So this book introduces our new druid. It's the Sentinel Druid. I think we've already previewed it on the website by this point, but it's actually the leader of this book. That's a slightly different approach than we took with the classic druid, the druid that's already appeared in 4th edition, so that we could have a leader in this book that wasn't the cleric. I actually think that that's one of the best things that 4th edition has done throughout its lifespan is introduce the leader role not tied to the cleric necessarily. So this way you can pick up this book, you can have your leader in the party that's not necessarily a cleric. And so that's the Sentinel Druid. We have a couple of rangers in this book. We have a striker ranger, which is your sort of classic two-weapon melee fighting ranger. And then we introduce a controller ranger, who is an archer. Now, there was a lot of people when 4th edition first came out, or even when we were sort of concepting the game, that thought that the archer archetype fit the controller role very well. So, obviously, you'll see the new ranger that does that. So, that's one thing I think is really cool. We've got the Hexblade Warlock. It is a melee warlock, which is a little different, but it follows the same sort of pact structure, just a little bit more involved in how it integrates the pact and your actual abilities.
Yeah, it's basically Elric.
Yes.
Elric of, how do you say it?
Melnibody.
Yeah, that's right.
With tremendous flexibility, one of the things I like about where we ended up with the Hexblade is even though the class is primarily focused on melee, Hexblades can also take warlock powers from the player's handbook And even many of the powers that the Hexblade has in Heroes of the Forgotten Kingdoms are ranged powers or close powers, area powers. Right. So they're very versatile spellcasters.
Right. And of course, the final one, not that I meant to leave it for last, but it's the Cavalier, which is the Paladin, the new Paladin in this one. And that's something that actually just today got previewed on the website. So some people have probably already seen that. But that's another sort of nod to the classic D&D archetype of the Paladin, right? He's very much your knight in a lot of ways, and he's got his bonded mount and his holy smite, but that's the classes in this book.
Now with the Sentinel, I'm going to go back to the first class that you mentioned, Rodney. How would you say this druid aligns with druids in past editions?
It's funny, when we were first concepting this druid, we really started thinking about how druids had appeared even as far back as first edition. And I think it's in Village of Hamlet, there's the druid with the bear companion, is that right?
Exactly.
Yeah, that's right. So when we started thinking about what do we want this druid to look like, that was actually, we started saying, well, okay, this is really the first druid that a lot of people were introduced to, right? Is this NPC in Village of Hamlet. So let's take a look at how that would shape a druid class, right? And we've already got our druid in the original Player's Handbook too. So this is more of a take on transforming the things that NPC inspires into a whole class. So you see he's got his animal companion, and we give you the choice between a bear and a wolf, though I believe he had a bear in Village of Hamlet, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
And, of course, that's in fact tied to the seasons. The big sort of choice you make when you become the Sentinel Druid is you choose which season you're going to be associated with. And we give you the choices of spring and summer right now. And spring is associated with the wolf, and then summer, of course, is associated with the bear. And that not only informs your animal companion choice, but sort of gives you a motif that goes throughout your weapons and the choices that you make throughout the entire progression of your class.
Yeah, what we wanted to do, like for example with the bear, if you choose summer, you're very good with big bludgeoning weapons, staves, clubs, you do more damage with those. If you go with spring, you're more the sort of speed, elegant weapons. I mean, that's where the scimitar sits, the spear, things like that. So to really give you, it's one of the big things that we try to do with Essentials, was create character classes that had very resonant options that rested within the game world. The mechanics were never divorced from the reality of D&D, the fiction, the game that you're playing. Everything is explainable within what's actually going on within the world of D&D. Mm-hmm. The Cavalier is very similar, where he has different virtues he chooses from to embrace. The Warlock, the Hexblade, his pacts are represented by the pact weapon he acquires. You know, the Fey Pact guy, I believe in this book he has, is it a rapier or is it just it's a rapier type weapon?
Mm-hmm.
The Diabolic Pact has more of a cruel sort of, I don't think it's actually an axe, it is still a blade, but it's more of a broadsword, heavier weapon.
Right.
And he is more likely to wear heavy armor, while the Fey Pact guy is more likely to wear light armor. So you can just imagine what this guy looks like. And that kind of gives you the framework that explains, well, here's how his pact works. It's the flavor reflected in the mechanics, reflected in the world. You know, it's in a lot of ways, it's starting with the world first, then building back to the mechanics.
And I think when we were going through the design process, that sequence of starting with world and ending up with mechanics was probably the most obvious when we worked on the Sentinel. Because we started with Village of Hamlet. We then moved on to the seasons and then associating animals with the seasons and then different themes for the magic with those seasons. And the mechanics all flowed from those things rather than us going the other way around and saying, oh, we want to achieve these particular mechanical goals and then attach story to them.
Exactly. It gives you a framework by which either an experienced player or a new player can easily comprehend what this class's story and therefore what its abilities and mechanics are.
Yeah, it makes it more intuitive to play. But at the same time, while we've gone with that very much story first and forming the mechanics approach, it turned out with the Sentinel that doing that created some space for some really interesting design that really pushed the boundaries of what we'd done before. For example, the animal companions are much more their own animal than, say, the Beastmaster Rangers, which was very much a sort of an abstract combat or concept, or the Shaman Spirit Companion, which is just a spirit, right?
Yeah.
So you look at the design space that was opened up by that, and it actually, this is something that's very different from what we've done in 4th edition so far, but pushing it in a direction that makes it something sort of new and exciting. And the other thing is, looking at the daily powers at first level, I went back and I started thinking about what the sort of classic things that you would expect a druid to do are, and I was reminded of spells like Heat Metal or Shillelagh, right? And I remember I was like, well, how would I do that in 4th edition? And that sort of started this chain reaction of, oh, okay, I'm going to create this new kind of daily power that's going to do this thing. And it's still just as interesting and compelling, and maybe even more so than some of the stuff we had been doing, right? Instead of just another daily power, now here's this sort of neat other way to do a daily power. And I think that people will see when they play this that not only does it sort of make sense, but it's also just as mechanically engaging as anything else. Like, you're going to think not only in terms of what makes sense for my character to do, but also what's interesting and how can I use this power to my greatest advantage. And I think that's really hits both of the high points of what's great about D&D.
Another class in the book who wields at least some primal magic is the Hunter Ranger, who is the controller. In Player's Handbook 3, we introduced the Seeker, an entirely primal class, also a controller, who most often is built as an archer. So what would you guys say distinguishes the Hunter from the Seeker?
Well, the key to the Hunter, probably the easiest way to think of him, is that he, with his split power sources, his martial and primal, he's using martial for his basic ability with the bow. He has a number of at-wills he can use, one of which has a couple different options for control effects, and that represents his pure marksmanship ability. As does his encounter power. He has an encounter power that has an additional layer. You choose one of several different control effects that have a save ends effect attached to them. And that represents just the pure ability of an archer. And then on top of that, within his utilities, he has access to primal spells. This is an area where there's always been a lot of questions about how would you do a martial controller. And you could, we could still go ahead and do just a pure martial controller.
Yeah.
Really just a matter of getting the flavor right.
Right, yeah.
But we just saw, with this case, we want to do a ranger. We want to do a ranger that felt like it had more of a primal influence, hence the split power source. But it also allowed us, within that class's utility powers, to introduce primal effects that are control, but that are still utilities. So, for example, a utility spell that creates a zone of difficult terrain, and the zone also provides cover to you and your allies. That's a control effect. You're basically making an area that it's hard for your enemies to enter or leave, or any one of those sort of movement manipulation zones. Entering this zone costs a lot of extra movement. If you leave this zone, you are immobilized until the end of your turn. Things like that. Those are very easily explainable with primal magic. They fit the motif of primal magic of, you know, causing roots to sprout from the ground, a small like cyclone of air to appear, things like that. And it's really just sort of a target opportunity in that just the flavor really worked well for that model of this archer who is the skilled marksman who's creating all these effects just through his great ability to aim with his bow, but who also learns these primal tricks he can use. You could, though, take the hunter and make a almost completely martial class just by taking ranger utilities that are martial.
Right.
You know, and then you'd have nothing but martial powers.
Yeah, there's really only, as far as I can tell, just a small number of primal abilities that are really hard-coded into the hunter. So you could build a hunter that's pretty much 90% martial if you really wanted to. I think that's perfectly fine. And I think when you want to think about the distinction between the Seeker and the Hunter Ranger, the Seeker is very much the 4th edition primal equivalent of the Arcane Archer. If you
right.
remember the Arcane Archer prestige class from 3rd edition, right? The Seeker crafts spells and uses his ranged weapon to sort of deliver those spells. Whereas the Ranger, the hunter ranger, he's still very much the martial marksman, right? He's not really crafting spells with his arrows or anything. What he is doing is he's using these sort of, I don't want to say minor tricks, but it's more like he's spent his life studying, and just through his interaction with things in the forest or in the wilderness, he's learned these primal tricks that he can use to create zones or, you know, things like that. So there's actually two different archetypes there that are really being served by those two different classes. And while there is some overlap in flavor, I would say no more than overlap between any two other classes.
Now, something that the scout, the two-weapon-wielding ranger who also appears in Heroes of the Forgotten Kingdoms, something that he shares in common with the hunter is he also is a martial character and a primal character. And so that's a theme now carried through both of the new types of ranger.
Yeah, and it's something we've obviously done elsewhere already. By this point, DDI subscribers have seen the Executioner Assassin, which was Marshall and Shadow, right? So I think it's just a matter of figuring out where the flavor fits best, and then assigning our power sources and the kinds of powers we want to use after we figure out, okay, this is the best story for this character. This is what we want this character to look like in the world. How do we make that interesting and exciting? And I think that gives us some really good direction.
So let's go back to the Cavalier for a moment. One of the things I like about this new type of paladin is that he's fully a paladin, yet he shares the defender mechanics that we introduced in the fighter knight in Heroes of the Fallen Lands. He has a defender aura, but rather than bashing people with a martial power to punish them for ignoring him and attacking his allies, he wields this holy smite. What are some other things you guys would say distinguishes the Cavalier from the Paladin in Player's Handbook 1?
Well, the big thing is definitely the heroic virtues the Paladin chooses from. What we wanted to do was say, if in the Player's Handbook, the Paladin there was very driven by divine magic. Obviously, it's a divine class, so that was always going to be an element of it. But you also have a D&D tradition of paladins who are not necessarily associated with a specific deity. You know, and I've seen this depicted in different ways in different campaigns within D&D, either, you know, personal campaigns or just characters in books and whatnot, that sometimes you have the paladin who is very similar to a cleric in that the paladin trained with a church, with a specific set of paladins within, you know, when I say church, I mean like the physical structure, like a monastery or something like that. And then you have this idea of the paladin as the sort of wandering hero. It's the person who decides that heroism for them isn't a choice, it's a calling. It's just they have an intuitive sense of right and wrong, of standing up for the little guy. It's a calling that transcends any sort of formal religious training. And in a way, we wanted to have with the Cavalier room for both of those. You can see the virtue is either an expression of a specific deity. So, for example, in this book, there's the virtue of sacrifice. You could easily see a deity such as, I'm going to use Ilmater, I don't know how to say it, from the Forgotten Realms. That would be a perfect model for a paladin who's dedicated to that god and who, like, a kind of, you know, traditional, trained within the structure of a church sort of paladin. But you could also just picture, like, the warrior who just feels this calling that whenever, you know, he sees suffering and pain in the world and he just can't help but reach out and try to either, you know, defeat the evil forces that are causing it, to give of himself to help those who've suffered, that there's more going on there than just, well, I went to this temple and trained a lot and learned a bit of swordsmanship. There's that kind of calling element to it. And so within the mechanics, a little bit like cleric domains from Heroes of the Fallen Lands, the virtues provide you with a number of pre-selected options, powers, and class abilities that tie into your character that give you a really meaty, sustained theme that carries your character from levels 1 to 30. It's not everything from the class, but it's a big chunk of it that really helps define you, and not only that, but helps contrast you with other Cavaliers who have chosen a different virtue.
So before we move on to talking about the Monster Vault, one question that we should probably answer is whether a player needs Heroes of the Fallen Lands if they're playing a character built with Heroes of the Forgotten Kingdoms. The answer is...
Oh, no. No, the books... There is some overlap in material presented. We wanted you to feel free to buy either of these books. I mean, if you want to buy both, I'm not going to stop you. That's fantastic.
Right. We certainly will not complain.
Yeah. But we wanted to make it more flexible, especially for new players. The way you can kind of think of it is with the starter set, Heroes of the Fallen Lands is a natural extension of the starter set. This book like Rodney mentioned before, the races are a little more fringe. The classes are a step away from the core four traditionally associated with D&D. They're a little bit more on the edge. So you can imagine if you bought the red box, the starter set, and you had a friend who's going to join your campaign or who made a character there, one person could go out and buy Heroes of the Fallen Lands, and someone else could go out and buy Heroes of the Forgotten Kingdoms, and that book kind of occupies the same space conceptually. Like, you know, well, that's the book I'll bring to the session to look something up. If I want to go buy some equipment, I can just look up the armor price or the price of a coil of rope. It's in that book. So we're not forcing you that if you buy one, you don't also need the other. Now, that said, the amount of material that overlaps, it isn't super high. I mean, the books are really page count-wise dominated by the classes. There are some differences between the magic items. Obviously, the items in the Heroes of the Forgotten Kingdoms are going to be more germane to those classes, and the same goes for Heroes of the Fallen Lands.
And there are a handful of feats in Heroes of the Forgotten Kingdoms that do not appear in Heroes of the Fallen Lands, and that's primarily to support the classes that appear in this second book.
Yeah, there are some feats that have more of a primal flavor to go along with the primal classes introduced in this book.
And rod expertise, because the warlock is in this book.
Right. Exactly.
And either book is meant to work fully with the rules compendium, and that's true of the entire Essentials line.
Yeah, it just gives you a little bit of choice when you decide what class I'm going to play. If you're coming to a new D&D game, either you never played before, you're just getting into Essentials, if you know in advance that you want to play the Ranger, this way you don't have to go out and buy Heroes of the Fallen Lands and Heroes of the Forgotten Kingdoms. You can sort of focus yourself. And then if you want to get the other one later, that's fine by me too, like Mike said.
Let's talk monsters.
Yes, let's.
Yeah, so let's lead it off. Overview of this product. It's a box set, Monster Vault. It comes with a booklet, 6x9 format. I say booklet, that's not doing it justice. It is 320 pages.
It's the same length as the rules compendium.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a book, let's just be clear.
It is a full-size book.
And the great thing is, compared to our monster format before this, the monster manuals, we had to shift things around in terms of the text just to account for the 6x9 format. But we've also included within each stat block a small picture, a portrait of that monster. Now, the portrait isn't always unique, because that portrait corresponds to the token that comes with the box set that you would use for that monster. So in addition to the book, I can't remember the number of sheets off the top of my head.
Ten.
It is a bunch of sheets.
There are a lot of tokens.
There are tokens for every monster in this book. I remember having the discussion when we were thinking about, well, if we're going to do this Essentials monster product, the DM will need something to, you know, indicate the monsters on the board. Wouldn't it be nice if you had tokens for all the creatures? And sure, it would be nice, so let's do it. You know, it's really when we could start doing more box sets now. That's something that option opened up for us. The tokens are all double-sided. One side has the portrait. It also has a number. If, for example, there are four goblin tokens with the same portrait, they'll be numbered 1, 2, 3, and 4, so easy reference during play. And then you can flip the token over, and the other side has a red ring around it to indicate that the creature's bloodied. So you're not in a situation where, really, like, I mean, if you look at the red box, a lot of the tokens, they had two sides with two different monsters on them. That's really just a packaging thing to keep the price low. You know, it's an intro product. We want to give you a complete experience, but we also don't want to charge you too much. In a dedicated monster product, we can go a little more luxurious with the components. So, and that's something that I found, I don't know about you guys, it's actually kind of useful, just the tokens, the numbering, and the bloodied. It's a little bit easier to track things in play compared to a miniature in some ways.
Yeah, so. I've actually, like, the Monster Vault was one of the books that I was really looking forward to the most, and I wasn't very sold on tokens originally, because I do have a pretty decent-sized minis collection. But then I took the now famous train trip to Gen Con this year, and on the train, I couldn't use miniatures because, frankly, they would just fall all over the place. So I used tokens, and it was very, very convenient. So now the Monster Vault has become basically my travel kit of monsters, because I don't have to worry about losing miniatures or finding the right ones, and they store very easily, right? Let's face it, a token takes up significantly less space than a miniature does. So absolutely, like, when I started working on this book and they said you're gonna have 10 sheets worth of monsters, I said, okay, this is probably gonna be the Essentials product that I personally want the most, just because I will get a ton of utility out of it.
And more than any of the other products, it is the product of, but wait, there's more. Because on top of this full-size book and all the monster tokens, there's also an adventure, and there's also battle maps in there.
Yeah, there's a poster map, yep. Double-sided. That ties into the Essentials idea for a new DM who comes in and starts with the red box that has the group adventure there. If you then move on to the DM's kit, there are adventures there to keep you playing. And then with the Monster Vault, if you can think of the DM's kit as like, this is what's going to teach you how to be a DM, and there are adventures in there that you're going to play to learn how to be a DM, then when you buy the Monster Vault, you're ready to start making your own adventures. There's still an adventure in there, so you can just dive in and start playing immediately, just keep your campaign going, while then you get used to the idea of creating your own adventure, drawing your own maps, using dungeon tiles or using graph paper or what have you. And at the end of it, you run a campaign to about 5th or 6th level, and now you're ready. You learn all the basics of the game. You learn how to be a DM. Now you learn how to be an adventure designer and a world creator. So there's really a progression built into the line for that.
Rodney, what can you tell us about the monsters that are in this book? Why these monsters? How were the selections made?
Yeah, so the process of making this book was very enlightening to me, because the first thing we did, obviously, was we had to figure out what monsters are going to go in this. And so what happened was I sat down with my other two designers, Logan Bonner and Matt Cernette, and we basically each made our wish lists of, we think these are the most iconic essential D&D monsters. And so we looked at those three lists, and we sort of winnowed those down and figured out what we decided was the design team's ultimate D&D monster list, right? We then took that to other people in the department and said, okay, what's missing off of this list?
I remember marking up that list.
Right, exactly. and so it went through a lot of different people, and basically we got a pretty good consensus on what we thought the essential monsters were to include in the book. And so from that point, we basically said, okay, we've got X number of pages to put for each of these monsters. Let's get the number of monsters we need. Let's get some really interesting story out there. I actually think that Monster Vault, one of its biggest advancements is that it's very readable, right? We really went out of our way to make sure that you can sit down with this book, read through the flavor text before a monster, and come up with a lot of good adventure and campaign and encounter ideas just by sitting down and reading through the flavor text. We actually really tried to focus on that sort of flavor design philosophy.
Which is something that we did not too long before this book in Monster Manual 3.
That's true. We certainly expanded it out there, and then it wasn't actually that long after we did those expansions that we started working on the Monster Vault, and so we were able to sort of take that and evolve it just a little bit more. The advantage of the 6x9 format is that it's really easy to put things in sort of paragraph form and have it read very much like you're just flipping through, you know, a novel or something like that. Mm-hmm. So there's actually a really nice thing about the formats here is that it makes it very easy to just sort of read casually and enjoy. And the philosophy we sort of took with this book was that we wanted every time you read this book, every time you read a new paragraph or a new sentence, it should be inspiring you in some way. And so that's really what we've tried to do. And I think it actually makes the book very exciting to read as a DM, even if you're already familiar with these monsters, because it's going to inspire you to make new adventures.
Rodney, since today we like asking you questions, how does this product fit into our ecology of other monster books in 4th edition? Let's say a DM has Monster Manual 1, Monster Manual 2, possibly also Monster Manual 3.
We can only hope.
Yes. And possibly also the Draconomicon and Open Grave and et cetera, et cetera. Where does this book fit in?
Well, it's a great jumping off point for new DMs, obviously, but for existing DMs, like I said, it's really a great place to go and find adventure ideas. I would say a very significant portion of the monsters in this book, the specific stat blocks, the specific mechanics, are actually new. So you're looking at a large percentage of effectively new versions of these existing monsters. There are some that we thought were really great iconic examples of the existing monsters that we wanted to revise and update, but there's a lot in here that has never seen the light of day. So on the one hand, it's very much like buying a whole new monster manual that just fits in, you know, right alongside things. But at the same time, with its focus on the iconic and it's really, really trying to bring in a lot of new adventure ideas, it's a great source of inspiration as well. So I would say that if you've already got, you know, Monster Manual 1, 2, 3 and the Dark Sun Creature Catalog, this sits alongside it very, very well and might also end up becoming your sort of go-to reference for the very core classic monsters. It works just fine with everything else. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, I have found over the last few months as I've been creating encounters for my home campaign that this is probably now my foundational monster book.
Sure.
But in almost every encounter, I now have a mix of Monster Vault monsters, Monster Manual 1 monsters, Monster Manual 2 monsters, Monster Manual 3 monsters, yeah, etc.
Very true. In fact, right now I'm running, for my Monday night Forgotten Realms game, I'm actually running a conversion of the 3rd edition adventure Lich Queen's Beloved, which was from Dungeon number 100, written by Chris Perkins. Great adventure with lots of Githyanki in it, obviously. It takes place in the Githyanki capital city. And so I'm using the Githyanki that are in the Monster Vault, but I'm also using the ones that are in Plane Above, which I happen to also have designed, but no bias there at all. But I'm also using some of the ones from other sources as well. There's a few dungeon adventures that have a lot of Githyanki in them, so it mixes and matches very, very well. I mean, the amount of flexibility that it gives you is fantastic, and obviously I've been working to recreate this 3rd edition adventure with the 4th edition design, and so far have found the Monster Vault to be a great addition, but it also, you know, it's not the only thing I use, right? There's a lot of different sources I pull from, so yeah, it's great for just adding to your encounter design arsenal.
So I have kind of an off-the-cuff question. It's a little bit off the script, and maybe it's going to be something where maybe I have to think for a second before I give you an answer. But I'm just thinking about, in general, like how we present monsters in 4th edition. And I'm looking here at the Roper entry. And actually, it's kind of a question for Rodney, but I'm kind of great, putting on the spot. So
yes, a little
this
bit.
This is how fair I am. It's not about just the Roper, but it's just in general. Traditionally in D&D, if you were to open a monster book to the Roper entry, say Monster Manual 1, there'd be the Roper and that's it. One of the things we do in 4th is, in this entry, there's a Roper. There are actually 3 Ropers. There's the Impaling Roper, the Crag Roper, and the Cave Roper. When you're designing monsters that way, when you take something that's very iconic like the Roper, and you're doing 2 or 3 different versions of it, how do you approach that from a design standpoint to make those creatures distinct, yet still make it feel like a Roper? And then there's the follow-up, which is it better to have a Roper entry with 3 Ropers, or would it be better to have 3 different monster entries that have these monster concepts in them?
Well, okay, so that second question, that's a long topic of conversation, sure, right? So let's go back to the first one. As for how I've approached it for this book, basically what we would do is we would look and say, what are sort of the essential things that a Roper, for example, needs to be able to do, and make sure that that exists across all 3 versions, right? Now, if we want them to behave slightly differently, I think that actually is really what makes the, you know, the 4th edition style of monsters interesting, is that these all feel like a Roper, but they feel like a Roper and do something slightly different, right? And I think that really all you need to do is make sure that that sort of essential Roperness sits at the very, very center of the monster. And that's most of what you see. But that way, like, okay, we fight a Roper at level 10, and it's got the, you know, the very basic stuff. But then we get to, like, level 12, and we fight another one. And it's doing many of the same things, but then, oh, it's got this, you know, this surprising thing that happens that surprises the players. And I think that that element of surprise is something that 4th edition does really, really well, because when you have multiple types of the same monster, the players, they know most of what to expect, but there's just this little fragment that can vary so much that it really brings back the sort of surprising element. I know that when I was playing 2nd edition, of course, I didn't get to play as much as I wanted to because I was in high school and then a little bit in college, but I would read the monster manual a lot, and it got to the point where there were very few surprises for me as a player. But with the 4th edition style, there are lots of surprises, and as a DM, if I feel like my players are getting a little too jaded, I just add another new surprise, right? And it's very liberating as a DM to be able to, you know, sort of create these versions of the existing monsters very, very quickly by just adding a few abilities on. Now, the question is it better to have a single, you know, Roper or to have those 3? That's actually, having said everything I've said up to this point, there is something very nice about being able to say, this is a Roper and this is exactly what it does. So I think it's actually what's best in and I'm just going to say this off the cuff, I reserve the right to change my mind down the road, right? But I think what I like best is if there is sort of the very basic, the Roper, right? Or the Orc, or the Goblin, right? So that maybe most of the time, even, you know what to expect. But having those little variants, even within the same monster entry, I think retains that element of surprise. So I like the idea that there is a an orc out there that is just orc, right?
Yeah.
Or a roper that is just, this is the roper. And then everything else is sort of built on top of that. In a lot of ways, you might think of it like you think of the third edition style of creating monsters, where there was the orc, and then you would add classes to it. And those classes would come with a lot of features and you know, special abilities. And that was nice, because you could say, okay, I know that the essential orcness of the orc is still in there underneath this pile of spells and you know, magic items and whatever, right? You knew what to sort of expect at the base, whereas in 4th edition, we don't add classes on top of things. We just add abilities, right? We've just sort of changed the philosophy slightly for how we get to that point. But in a lot of ways, it's sort of the same thing, right? There is a base roper in my mind that is underneath all of these, right? And maybe we didn't necessarily publish the base roper, although the impaling roper, the level 10 lurker, is very close to that, what I would consider that base roper, right? And then everything else is just sort of layered on top of that so that, you know, much like we would layer a class on top of a third edition monster, we've instead layered a small number of abilities on top of this monster. And I think that's my preferred philosophy, but again, I reserve the right to change my mind.
And also there is a very practical difference between many of these different versions, and that is they're at different levels.
True.
And in a game that has 30 levels of play, potentially, we want to provide DMs the opportunity to feature many of these iconic monsters at various points across that vast level span. And that's one, if people ever wonder, well, why are there all these different carrion crawlers? Because they're actually, I was amazed that there were so many carrion crawlers in this book. They're going to spill out of the pages. But it means, hey, wherever you are in this vast span of levels, you can run into a carrion crawler.
Yeah, I don't think there is one right answer.
Yeah.
Because even within 4th edition, you can see there is variation. An orc entry will have the orc archer, the orc scout, the orc thief. Clearly, those orcs are different because they've acquired different skills. They have different type of training. The dragon entries, the dragons are categorized by age. Younger dragons are lower level. Older dragons are higher level and tend to have a slightly different array of powers. So I just think that was an interesting question to pop, because I was looking at the Roper entry, I was thinking of some of the other entries, and I don't think there's a canonical, this is the right way to do it. I think it's just kind of curious. Kind of want to get some, just hear what you guys thought about that. So that brings us to our mailbag. Take it away, Jeremy.
We have time for one question today, and this is a question from Andy. Andy asks, how strongly do you recommend that a party fill out all four of the character roles? What if no one wants to play a leader, for instance, or a controller? How hard or easy a time do you think the party would have?
You will have as hard a time as the DM wants you to have.
Right. Yeah, that's basically exactly it, right? If your DM wants to throw lots of high damage monsters at you, you're probably going to want that healer, right? You're going to want that leader hanging out. But I think it's very possible to play without certain roles. And in fact, I would say that you can, like, as long as your DM is willing to make a few, you know, adjustments and considerations, right? You could play without any of those individual roles, right? I mean, you could have three strikers and a defender and leave out those other two roles. As long as your DM takes that into consideration, I think that's very doable.
And I think each of us has played in games during this edition where we did not have members of every role.
Yeah, we have 8 people in my Wednesday night game, and we have no controller.
But you're probably doing lots of damage, probably like 6 strikers.
Yeah, yes, we have I think 3 or maybe 4 strikers. Although, having said that, we just leveled up to 21st level, and I'm going to be hybriding into a controller class. So,
okay.
You know, we will have half of a controller.
Yeah, it's, I think it's pretty simple. If you don't have a controller, you don't want to use too many minions. We had that actually happen in the Keep of the Borderlands game, where you're fighting about 20 kobold minions at a go. And there was one session, either the wizard wasn't there, Rodney's wizard, or were you poisoned and you were slowed until the extended rest? Or was that?
I wasn't there yet, because I didn't play the first couple sessions.
There was one time when you weren't there, and there's one other time when you were trapped in one room.
Right.
The yes. rogue ran behind you, and so yes. A bunch of kobold minions came running in. And that was, it was curiously murderous in the party, with like 12 kobold archers firing at once, and it got pretty nasty, but then the wizard, I think that was the one encounter where you finally came back to the room.
Right.
And with
the
one
wizard
spell,
just destroyed all of them.
Boom.
It took a while because I got cornered by a kobold. But yeah, I mean, that's another case where, like, the game would be balanced normally if the controller was in there, you know, blasting away and everything. But take that controller out of it and don't adjust the encounter, and all of a sudden it becomes much, much more deadly. Yeah. And that's just adding minions, yeah. Right?
And this was also kind of an outlier. I was running almost nothing but minions when the party was attacking this.
Yeah, that was a very unusual encounter.
Yeah, but it was fun. I actually came away from that thinking I might just always use, like, kobolds are always minions from now on.
Yeah, I actually, you know, despite having said that we were totally getting obliterated, I had a blast, right? Yeah. Like, that was a great session, and we're sitting here remembering it and talking about it. So sometimes, actually, adversity can lead to a lot of fun.
I mean, my Hexblade kept, you know, jumping up on the table and getting knocked unconscious.
That's what I learned the party's weakness. The party's weakness is tables. If there's a table, someone will get on it, and that person will be immediately dropped to 0 hit points.
Yes.
This happened, I think, three rounds in a row.
Subsequent rounds, basically. Yep. Someone jumped on a table and then was immediately reduced to 0 hit points.
Yeah, I'm just thinking, there's a dozen kobold archers here. Who are they going to shoot at? The guy stuck down in the melee, the guy standing up on the table, and they all unleashed on the guy standing on the table.
Yes.
Just to close on this question, to make sure it's clear to all of our listeners, with the roles, the roles are really there to help you create an optimal party. You do not have to fill all the roles to create a functional party.
Yes.
Like, if you want the traditional Dungeons & Dragons party where you have, you know, in the old days what would be called, you know, the fighter, the cleric, the rogue, and the wizard, and we still have those four classics, but now there are other classes who can sort of stand in for them. And we let you know that another class can stand in for them by using the role label. If you want that classic structure, sure, fill each of those roles. But as was the case in previous editions, you can have a totally successful party and lack a member of one of those roles.
Exactly.
In a lot of ways, it can make encounters more tense, right? I mean,
yes.
We've had sessions where our defender doesn't actually make it to the session because of real life concerns or whatever, and that turns out to be a very tense session. We've made it through that session, right? We might have all gotten captured and thrown in jail, or, you know, had a character die or something, but those are extremes, obviously, right?
And you know what? I have to admit that as a player, many of my favorite encounters in 4th edition have been the ones where there was no defender.
Right.
Because I actually have enjoyed when the strikers, the leader, and the controller were forced to come up with clever ways to, you know, lead the monsters around the encounter area, you know, retreat to a particular area, fight, 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 retreat to another area, fight, 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 fight. That I found the encounters became even more dynamic, even more mobile. We had to, you know, strain our healing resources to the limit and come up with very clever ways to use the controller's abilities. So it was a case of adversity creating even more enjoyment.
Yeah, and it's actually a great point that you can often compensate for a missing party role, if you want to say missing, just with your tactics, right? By changing the way you approach the encounter, you can basically substitute good strategy and good tactics in for a particular role.
Well, that just about wraps it up for this episode of the D&D Podcast. On behalf of Jeremy and Rodney, I'd like to thank you for tuning in. As usual, if you have any questions, comments, or concerns, send us an email at dndinsider@wizards.com. That's the letter N on an ampersand. Until next time, good gaming, and keep rolling those dice.